classical mechanics, and I have basically three goals in this course. First, to review classical mechanics and maybe go a little bit deeper than you did in your undergraduate course. Second, to teach you some basics of differential geometry. And so differential geometry will be used heavily in relativity course, which is the core course coming in September, but also in later courses. So this will provide you some background for that. It will not be mathematically rigorous, but it will give you some flavor of what's going on. It'll be reasonably rigorous. And finally, I would like to show you that there are more applications of differential geometry than just relativity and things. And so one of the beautiful applications of this is exactly classical mechanics. And it has beautiful description in terms of so-called symplectic geometry. And I would like to make some introduction to symplectic geometry and to formulation of classical mechanics in this differential form language. Okay, so I gave you the plan, and basically, so the first week will be introduction to differential geometry and Lagrangian mechanics, and next week we will do the Hamiltonian mechanics. And so the plan is ambitious. I will probably not be able to cover all the topics listed here, but I will try, and if needed, I'll do some selection of the topics. Additional reading, so I'll be writing some kind of lecture notes, which are in some state, but they are not complete, and there are many mistakes. But anyway, so I'll be writing these notes. They will be usually available, let's say, 2 days after the lecture. But of course, you are encouraged to write your own notes, because that's the best thing. Let me also mention classic books on classical mechanics. So first of all, Landau and Lipschitz, this beautiful book, 100 pages long, but it has everything in it. And it's beautifully written, and very, very simply written. Now, the book I'll be following more is Arnold, which is like Mathematical Methods for Classical Mechanics. And that's quite heavy book, so I'll try to do it. So Arnold, Mathematical Methods. Methods of Classical Mechanics. Also, probably a book which you have encountered is Goldstein, Classical Mechanics, you're probably familiar with in your previous studies. Also useful is actually study text written for Cambridge Part 3 by David Tong, Classical Dynamics, but it's a little bit lower level than we will be using in this course. And if you speak Czech, you can also study by Podolsky, Theoretical Mechanics in Language of Differential Geometry. That's a translation of the title, but otherwise it is in Czech. But the formulas are universal, so you can perhaps still use it. So anyway, so this will be basically the main source for this. So please ask questions whenever you have any. Any questions at this point? No. So let me maybe just directly dive into this. So chapter one will be introduction to differential geometry. And as I said, we are not mathematicians, so we don't need really very exact definitions, but we need some exactness. So I'll try to keep some balance between, you know, exact mathematical rigorous approach and physical approach. So part A will be manifolds and tensors. Okay, so let me start explaining what a manifold is. So a typical picture, you can think about a manifold is, well, I draw something like this. And you can have some holes in the manifold here. But what really makes it a manifold is that in n-dimensional manifold M, so this will be my manifold M in n dimensions, is that locally, if I zoom on each toe, I have a point on the manifold here, and if I zoom around that point, I basically see something which is like a Euclidean space R to the n. So manifold has differential structure like R to the n locally, but not necessarily its global properties. So it can be distinguished from R to the n globally. Also, some people like to think about the manifolds as embedded in some higher dimensional space. So for example, if I draw the axis x, y, and z here, then you might want to think that the manifold lives in this Euclidean space R to the 3, but that's actually not a very useful concept. Moreover, so there are embedding theorems, so any manifold can be embedded in sufficiently higher dimensional space, but it's not very useful. So don't think about manifolds as embedded in high dimensional space. Okay, so that was just some words to the introduction, so let me just now write a work version of definition of what a manifold is. Definition. So n dimensional manifold M. And now this is, if you have taken some mathematical courses, you'll be laughing at me, is a set of points together with a collection of subsets denote them O alpha, so alpha is some index which runs from how many subsets you have. That satisfying. And now there will be three requirements. So the first requirement is that basically you cover everything on the manifold, so each point which belongs to the manifold lies in at least one of these subsets, at least one O alpha, which means that that is if you take all the subsets, they cover your manifold. Okay, so that's very intuitive and a nice requirement. So I really want to, you know, at any point I can mention on the manifold, there is the subset O alpha, which where the point actually lies. So second one, for each alpha, there is, and now one on one onto map psi alpha, which maps my region O alpha to a subset of R to the n. U alpha, where U alpha is an open subset of R to the n. Okay. And finally, the last requirement is that what happens if actually, you know, there is a point which is covered in one O alpha and in another O alpha prime. So if any two sets let's say O alpha and O beta overlap, that means O alpha O beta is not equal to zero, then the map now I'll write it, and then I'll explain what it means later. So psi beta composed is psi alpha to minus 1 is smooth, is infinitely differentiable. Okay, so these are the three conditions which you have to satisfy, and if you satisfy them, you can call the object a manifold. Okay, so what does it mean? So if I want to draw a picture of this, then this is our manifold. We still have the holes there. And let's say I choose, so for I can always, well, for every point, so let's say there's a point P living on that manifold. And so according to the first requirement, for each P, I have to have some kind of O alpha. So there's a region O alpha. And for that O alpha, I have to have a map which maps that region of the manifold to my Euclidean space. Okay, so this thing, so there's a psi alpha map which maps this into R to the n. And there'll be some region in R to the n where this is mapped to. Okay. But so that's basically the point number 2. And then the funny part is that if you have two such regions, so for example, I have O beta region here, and there is an overlap, then of course this O beta region has a corresponding map. Psi beta, which maps to the flat space. So this is U alpha, and this is U beta. Okay. So now there's this overlap here, which means that only part of the region is sort of corresponds to my intersection of the two regions, and there's another part of the region which corresponds to the intersection here. Okay. And then you require that the map which goes from here to there is smooth. So what is this map? So this map is I have to go first to the manifold and then from the manifold all the way here. Right? So that map is precisely psi beta. So this map is psi beta minus 1 composed with psi alpha. So it's probably the other way around than I did it in that definition. And so this thing is C infinity. Okay. So now, because you have these maps available, the psi alpha and the psi beta, you can always map whatever happens in R to the n to whatever happens in R to the n. So you can just describe things in terms of, you know, functions which go from R to the n to R to the n, and then you don't then you know how to do geometry and differentials and stuff like that. You know what a C infinity function from R to the n to R to the n is, right? So these maps really allow you to map everything from something you already know. Okay. So, questions to this? So, just some definitions. So, these size are called charts by mathematicians or by physicists, simply coordinate systems. So now if you have lots of charts, then you have an atlas. So the collection O alpha together with the corresponding maps, psi alpha, is called atlas. Okay, so the whole point of this horrible definition, if you want, is just really to say, you know, a manifold is made of pieces which look locally look like R to the N and are smoothly sewn together. So you can put them together smoothly. Okay? Questions? Okay. So you see that in this definition there is nothing about embedding the manifold in higher dimensional space or whatever. And this is, you know, that's the way to think about manifolds. You don't want to think about they are living in some higher dimensional space or whatever. It's just all intrinsic definition of the manifold. Okay. So now examples, of course. So if you want to think about some examples, then the simplest example are, well, traditional steady example is just a sphere. So let's say I have S2. Here, and you can actually check yourself that it satisfies all the required properties. So another example would be a torus. So torus is something. So take a piece of your sheet and identify like that, and identify like that, and that's your torus thing. So you take this thing and identify this side as that side, and identify this side as that side. So you create a torus. So here you identify. That's another example of a manifold. Both of them are two-dimensional manifolds. Finally, the question is for you. Let's say I have a cone, or let's say a light cone. Is this a manifold? Does it look always as R2?
Point in the middle.
Exactly. So it would be if this point were not there, but because it is there, and at that point I don't really have R2. And it's not smooth, then this is not a manifold. Okay. So now, why we are interested in manifolds is that, so as I said, the primary application of differential geometry and all these things is if you talk about relativity and you talk about motion of particles and so on. And actually, particles, if they move in the space-time, they actually need manifolds. They need sufficiently smooth environment so that everything is well defined and there are no problems, no singularities, and stuff like that. So just note, in GR, in general relativity, we need manifolds. Because otherwise, particles have problems, point particles. Interestingly, if you will do that in the review course, if you study string theory, you don't need manifolds. Actually, strings are extended objects, and they don't mind singularities that much. So if there is some kind of non-smoothness in your space-time, then it's still OK for strings. So in string theory, actually, what you can replace by manifolds, so in string theory, and you will learn about that in the review, in string theory, can use something which is more general than a manifold, and it's called, for example, an orbifold. It's OK. So an example of an orbifold is, for example, you take a line in R1, and you identify x with minus x. Okay, so which has R1 over Z2, And so there's a singularity in the origin because there's a singularity in the origin. So this is not a manifold, but it's an orbifold. For particles, you have problems. For strings, it's okay. Okay. So it's just a note. You will study this in the next term. Questions? So now we know what a manifold is. So now we can equip this manifold with some additional structures. Okay, so the simplest additional structure is a scalar function. So a scalar function call it F is a map which goes from the manifold to, let's say, the real numbers. Okay, so I have my manifold here. I take a point P, and then what the function does is it assigns to this point P some real number F of P. Okay, so function lives on the manifold, and for each p, it gives me some number. So now the question is, what happens if you change the chart, right? So let's say I have one chart, including this point p or alpha, and then the corresponding psi r to the n, and then I have some coordinate x here. And then I can describe the same situation, perhaps, in some O prime. OK, let's put O and O prime. Sorry for that. And then I'll have psi, and then psi prime, which is, again, r to the n, and then some coordinate x prime. So then you know that f evaluated at that point p should definitely not depend on which chart I'm using, right? It's simply, it's defined for this point p and should give me some number, let's say 5, right? And it doesn't matter whether I describe it, the situation in this coordinate system or in that coordinate system. So the number still has to be 5. So what it means is that f of p is the same thing as f x of p. So if I describe it in this coordinate system x, or in the chart psi, or f prime x prime of p, or in that coordinate system here. Okay, so this is like a, if you don't, well, okay. So in other words, it means, well, people usually put prime here. So it means that f prime x prime is the same thing at f of x, because it doesn't really matter on x. It only depends on what p is, right? You are defining completely invariantly, you are defining what happens for this point p. It doesn't matter which coordinate system you are using. Okay? And so this is the transformation property for scalar functions, right? So this is how scalar functions transform. If you change coordinates from x to x prime, if you are using either this chart or that chart, then this must be true. Does it make sense? Yeah?
Do you want it to be C infinity if you pull back by one of the charts to Rn? Or can it be any arbitrary map?
Sorry, what was the question?
Do you want it to be C infinity when you precompose with one of the charts? Or should it be any map?
Well, we are physicists. Everything is C infinity for us, okay, right? But in principle, I think you could play with the fact that f doesn't have to be necessarily infinitely differential. But then you have problems, right? You may have problems. So for us, everything is CC infinity.
Okay.
Yeah, just to make. Other questions? So an example of this, so this is very important. People usually define what a scale means, that in one coordinate system, it's exactly the same value as in another coordinate system. So you may think about, let's say, I have Earth, and then at each point on the Earth, I have some kind of temperature. So then this temperature does not depend on, you know, which coordinate system I'm studying this, whether I'm describing this from the plane or whether I'm describing this, you know, sitting, eating my breakfast and so on. It's still the same temperature. So that would be an example of a scalar function. Well, almost. Another example would be, let's say, intrinsic curvature. So an example of a scalar is curvature. So if I have my manifold and it may be curved like whatever, so there's a way how to measure how curved it is. And that's described by curvature, scalar. And so this would be an example of a scalar. So it would be same in any coordinate system. Right? Because, yeah.
Is that a condition like such that this is true, or it's a consequence?
Well, so what you really want to describe is that for each given p, I get a value, okay? So then this is a consequence of the definition, if you want, right? So that I'm just saying, you know, if I describe it in this coordinate system or in that coordinate system, the value doesn't change. It only depends on p. It doesn't depend on x or x prime. Okay. So another concept may be a curve. So a curve, let's call it gamma on M, is again a map. Which goes from some interval I, which is a subset of R1, to M, such that, okay, I'll write it down. So again, I have my map, psi alpha, composed with gamma, and then T will parameterize my interval. And so in local coordinate system, it will be x1t, x2t, xnt. And so this has to be smooth again. So what's going on? So that's basically a definition. So I have my manifold here, and I want to describe a curve gamma. Okay, so now what you are saying is that my curve gamma is basically I take an interval, so it has to be one-dimensional curve. And let's say it goes from this point to that point. So I take a line in R1, so this is my R1. I take an interval I, which goes, let's say, from A to B, and then I map this through this map gamma to my manifold. Of course, there's now again the map from the manifold through this psi to r to the n. And then I have a curve in r to the n. So basically, gamma takes you from that interval in R1 to the manifold. And then psi takes you from the manifold to R to the n. So in the end, you have a map. Psi composed this gamma, which is this thing. And then t parameterized, this is where t lives. So t belongs from A to B. And it gives me x1, x2, x3, x4 in this space. So that's what this map is. Okay, and that has to be smooth. So again, I'm mapping from R1. To Rn, and I know what smooth means there. Simple? Yep.
So you can only define a curve in a certain chart?
Sorry?
You can only define the curve.
Oh, well, I can choose another chart, yeah, if you want.
As a curve.
So, you know, what really matters is this map from I to here. Okay? So then if I choose another chart, these things will change, of course. They will look differently, but yeah.
But I guess, what can curves cross charts, like change charts in the middle?
of course. And that's usually a problem. Whenever your coordinate system, you know, ends, so for example, if I have a coordinate system which covers this part, you know, I'm happily describing the curve over here, but once I reach the boundary, I usually have a problem. Something bad happens. Usually, that's the end of your coordinates, and something usually blows up, or you find that it doesn't make any sense, and so on. It's an example of a black hole. So if you have a black hole horizon, that's where your coordinates actually end, and you find very weird things happening on the black hole horizon. But actually, there is a way how you can maybe extend this chart, you know, find a different chart which goes through this. And if you use that chart, you suddenly find, well, actually, my gamma is OK. There's no problem there. OK? So similarly, you can do a surface. So surface is just a two-dimensional version of a curve. So the definition is exactly the same. So a surface S is a map. So now you go from a region, which is a subregion of R2, so it's a two-dimensional version, to M. And otherwise, it's exactly the same, such that psi alpha composed with S. So now, because you have, it's a subset of R2, you have two things which actually parameterize your things. So let's use string theory notation tau and sigma. So two variables characterizing my surface, telling me where on the surface I am. So I know how much I have to go this way and how much I have to go that way. That's my subregion U. OK, and again, this is equal to x1 sigma and tau, x2 sigma and tau in some coordinate chart, and xn sigma and tau. And this has to be smooth. OK, so the picture is I have R2. Now I have this subregion U. And then you map this to a manifold. There is a region, surface S. And this is my map S. Okay, so now examples. So of course, an example of a curve would be a trajectory of the particle, for example. So you have a particle, it leaves behind a curve, a trajectory of a particle. Or maybe you have heard this fancy term, which is called word line, particle word line. Okay, so particle leaves behind it a curve where it was, and that's called word line. And similarly, if you have two-dimensional things, so you have a string, and it moves, you know, throughout the space-time, because you have an extended object, something, and that moves, it leaves the surface behind it, right? So if I have, well, this is my string, and as it moves, it leaves my sheet, right? So it's word sheet. So this example would be a worksheet. Sheet of a string. But of course, you don't have to have that fancy things. So here you can have also a river on the surface of the earth. And then here you can have a lake on the surface of the earth, right? OK, so far so good. So far very easy. So now very complicated. Very complicated concept. And that is what a vector is. OK, so now this is rather complicated. So let's do it slowly. A tangent vector. Well, I will not do it very slowly, but I'll try to explain something. So a tangent vector. So it's another object which can live on my manifold, sort of. And the way to think about tangent vectors is basically, a vector is determines some direction. And so you can think about it in terms of the components of the vector in a given basis, and that's what's usually done in high school. But you can also think about it as a differential operator, which differentiates your functions in that direction. It has very special direction. So tangent vector is associated and so the latter notion is actually, you know, simpler to define in more general settings as manifolds. So let's do it this way. So with direction of a derivative, at a point. So if you have in R to the n, so you can think about the vector in terms of the components v1, v2, and so on, vn. So that's the old perspective on what a vector is. It's a set of numbers, set of n numbers, which tells you something. So now the equivalent point of view on this thing is that, let's say, I take these numbers and associate with these numbers. And of course, these numbers make sense only when you say what the basis is. So let's say this thing tells you how much you move along the x-axis. This one tells you how much you move along the y-axis, and so on. So you have to specify what the basis is, x, y, z, and so on. So similarly, you can think about it. You assign a differential operator, dx mu. And you can act with this. So this is a differential operator. So once I know what these v mu are, I can also sandwich it with this d over dx mu, and I have a differential operator. And that's an equivalent point of view, how you can think about this. So in particular, if I have x1 axis and x2 axis, so basically d over dx1 tells me I differentiate my function in this direction, and d over dx2 tells me I differentiate my function in that direction. So I'm interested in how the function changes in this direction or that direction, and so on, right? So then you define an operator v acting on some function f is precisely this thing here, v mu df over dx mu. And if I calculate this at a point, then this is just a real number. So for any given function, this will give me some something, right? It'll give me the derivative of that function with respect to the direction, and it's some number at a point, okay? So this is what you can think about as a vector. It's either this way or that way for any function. Yeah.
Mean the unit vector in the direction.
It doesn't have to be a unit vector. It can be, you know, any vector. Any vector can be, and then you have, you know, just you. If it's twice unit, you will have twice as much real number here. Okay. So this one doesn't work. It doesn't. Okay. So now, when we have a differential operator, yes.
Isn't that last thing that you wrote down a function of a number?
Very good. So it is a function of a number?
Yes. The v mu partial f to x mu. I mean, you're just taking a linear combination of the under that.
This one here.
That one.
Okay.
You're just taking a linear combination of derivatives of functions. How is that a number?
I specify a function. So let's say x squared.
Okay.
Okay. And then I And then this v mu is something concrete. So let's say I know that v mu is just 1 and 0.
You're applying your function to a point. You're applying it to a certain coordinate.
At a point. Okay. This is all at a point. So at a point, it gives me a number. If you extend all over all points, then you get a function.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, so now we have a differential operator, and what is the characteristic property of a differential operator? Can anybody tell me? What is the most basic property of a linear differential operator?
Leibniz rule.
Leibniz rule, and?
Linearity.
Exactly, and that's it. Okay, so this is characterized by linearity. And Leibniz rule. Everybody knows what Leibniz rule is? If you differentiate the product of two functions, you get a differential of the first one times the second one, plus differential of the second one times the first function. Okay, so that's what Leibniz rule is. Okay, so by the way, here, for the first time, I have used Einstein summation convention. So what Einstein summation convention is that whenever you see the index twice, you actually sum over the thing. Okay, so what this means is v1 df over dx1 plus v2 d over dx2 plus v3 d over dx3 and so on. So people try to evaluate the contribution of Einstein in terms of money, and they realize that probably the biggest contribution is invention of this Einstein summation convention. You know, just imagine how much paper was saved and how much ink was saved during the years people are writing these formulas, right? So you don't have to write the sum. So what it means explicitly is sum over mu 1 to the n v mu df over the x mu, and we are just not writing this part here. Okay, so that's what happens in R to the n. And then, surprisingly, this definition through the differential operator works for manifolds as well. So a definition, what a vector on a manifold is precisely something which satisfies, which is a linear differential operator, which means it is linear and it satisfies the Leibniz rule. Okay, so. On our definition, so first, let F, curl F, be a collection of smooth functions. Okay, then what you call by a tangent vector, V at point P in the manifold is a map which to every function prescribes a real number, precisely S over there. That is linear. Okay, so what linear means, let me write it once. So if I take a vector and I eat a linear combination of two functions, f and g, where a and b are real numbers, then you get, this is a times V of F plus B times V of G for A and B real numbers. So that's what linearity means. And second obeys Leibniz. That means V F of G is V of F. And G of P plus V of G and F of P. Okay, so that's a formal definition what you mean by a tangent vector on a manifold. So something.
So a vector is a map.
So vector is a map which likes to eat functions and gives you a real number. And it's linear and it's a derivative, basically. Okay, so that's what a vector is. So now it takes some pain, which I'm not going to go through, to show that if you have a vector, then you can write it in nice form, in nice basis. Okay, so this is a definition, and a theorem says. So now let me put a theorem. Okay. Now the set of tangent vectors at my point P. Well, the first part is a definition, but forms a tangent vector space. That's the definition of what you mean by tangent vector space. A tangent vector space . So this one is usually denoted, so for each p it will be different, so it depends on t, on the point p, and t stands for tangent vector space, and of a given manifold m, so tp of m. Okay. So now what is the part of the theorem is that this tangent vector space actually is basically r to the n again. So this tangent vector space forms a tangent vector space which has the same dimensionality as M, and then, so in each vector space, you can choose the basis of the vectors. And so this basis, I'll use the coordinate basis, and it has it on very, very suggesting form. So with coordinate basis, d over dx mu, precisely, this direction or that direction or whatever direction, d over dx mu, for mu, 1 to the n. Okay, it's first part of the theorem, and I still continue. Any vector V can be expressed in this basis can be expressed as what we already seen there, expressed in the form So I have my vector v, and it has some components, v mu, and the basis d over dx mu. So we already know everything here. This is just, you know, very, very formal thing. So in this form, where these things are called components, and this is my basis. Okay, so that's what the theorem says. Okay. So it's precisely what is written here is, you know, the basis tells me I move along this direction, I differentiate with respect to that direction or that direction or whatever. And the component of the vector, the v mu, tells me, okay, so what is actually how much I move along this direction, along v1. So v1 tells me I move 1 along this direction, or 2, or 3 along this direction. V2 tells me I move 3 along that direction, and so on. So these are the components of the vector, tells me how much I move, and this is telling me along which direction I am moving. Okay. So a picture, standard example. So let's say you have a sphere. Okay, so now I have this direction, and then I have theta direction. And this is my point P. Okay. So now, if I have my sphere like that, then if I make a tangent plane to that, that's what you mean by this tangent vector space TP of M. Okay, so this thing will be, the tangent sheet will be TP, and M is now S2. TP of S2 is my tangent space. It touches the sphere at that point P. And then I have vectors which span my tangent space TP of that, which are tangent vectors to my curves, if you want. And so this is my vector d over d phi, basis here, and this is d over d theta on the sphere. So this is S2. Now, tangent space is the tangent sheet at that given point. It's a two-dimensional vector space, TPS2, and it's spanned by this vector and that vector. And so any vector which lives in this tangent space, V, will be just a linear combination of this and that. Okay, so questions. That's what you mean by tangent vector. So really, you know, think about vectors as something which likes to eat functions and gives you a number. But then that definition actually leads to something which you are basically familiar with. It has, the vector has some components, and it has some specific basis. The basis you can change, of course. Changing the basis doesn't change the vector. Okay, so now what? A vector is an invariant object in the manifold. So no matter which coordinate basis I'm using, the vector is still the same object. Okay, so what it means is that under a change of coordinates, that means my coordinate here is changing, so my basis is changing. What happens? So the vector is invariant, so v stays the same. So I once write it in this form, so v mu, so this is in coordinate system x, d over dx mu, d over dx mu. And then if you want to find what happens in a different coordinate system, all you have to do is the chain rule for the derivative. Okay, so this is the same thing as v mu of x And now I apply a chain rule on this. So this is equal to dx prime nu over dx mu d over dx prime nu. Okay, just the chain rule. But if you look at, well, this thing has to be, so this is my new basis, d over dx prime, so in new coordinates. So what stands here must be my new component of the vector. So this is by definition v prime nu of x prime d over dx prime nu. Okay. So we obtain how the components of the vector actually transform under the change of coordinates, and it's v prime nu of x prime is whatever is written there, v mu of x dx prime mu dx mu. Okay, so this you are probably familiar with if you have taken special relativity or some other courses. So really, people usually say, well, vector is something that transforms according to this rule. The components of the vector transform according to this rule. Okay, so that's true, but it's very confusing because it really obscures the fact that that vector is an invariant object. So no matter which coordinate system I am using, vector stays the same. It's still this vector here, no matter which coordinate system I'm using. Still the same vector, but I'm just describing it in different coordinates. Okay. But yes, you can derive this that the components of the vector change in this thing. So, but let me stress. And so the whole trick is to use the chain rule, and that gives you the right thing. But let me stress, this is an invariant object. So if you talk about a vector like the components plus the basis, nothing changes. It's the same in all coordinate systems. Questions? Okay. We have 15 minutes, that's good. So we now understand what a vector at a point is. But there was already a question, you know, why to consider a point? Why not to go over the whole manifold, right? So if now I use this thing here, but I don't specify this at a point, but I allow this to vary, you know, from point to point, then of course this thing here will be a function of that point. So actually, it will be a function again. So this thing, if I don't specify it at point one point p, it will be a new function, which of course depends on f and depends on my vector. And so this is what you mean by a tangent vector in the whole manifold. Definition. A tangent vector V, now I don't say at a point, but it will be in the whole manifold, is defined as S. So now basically a collection of all these tangent vectors at a point, which we already know what they are, which live in my tangent space at a given point. But now you let it run for all p in the manifold. For all p in the manifold. But of course, again, you are a physicist, so you require that this is a nice mapping that basically, let's say if I have my manifold, I have, let's say, a vector here at this point, and suddenly, you know, in just very nearby point, you would be going the other direction. That's not very nice. So you want that actually this is nice and smooth as you vary through the manifold. So that V of F, so now this is a function on the manifold, is smooth. Okay, so that's the definition. So now we extended the vector from one point to all over the manifold. Okay. Now V of F is a function of the manifold, and you know what a function of the manifold, how to define that it's smooth. Okay. And finally, a definition, another definition is that we have this tangent space at a point P, but if you take all the tangent spaces at all P's, you get something bigger, and it's called tangent bundle. Okay. So a tangent bundle so now it doesn't have the P in it, it's just a sum over all P. Okay? Well, that's the definition. Everybody happy with tangent vectors and tangent bundles and everything? So note.
How do you define a tangent vector field in the first one?
Sorry?
Do you want to call it tangent vector or tangent vector field?
Oh, you can call it tangent vector field. Yeah, if you want. Tangent vector field, yeah. People sometimes abbreviate and say just the vector, you can say vector field. Yes. Other questions? So note that TM, so the tangent bundle, has local coordinates so you first have to specify where on the manifold you are, so you have to specify where your P is. And that is defined by the coordinates of that point P in the manifold. So given a coordinate chart, I know what the coordinates of my point P in the manifold are. So it definitely has, these coordinates, but also it has the components of the vector, because, if I have an object in T of M, it is a vector which lives at that given point in that tangent space. Okay, so it has basically the components of the vector and the coordinates of that point specify a point in the tangent bundle. Yes.
In the in the curly braces, so it says P and TP of M. Do you mean for those P's to be different things?
Sorry, which one? This one?
It's
the same thing. So okay. So I have
one point.
So I have one point P, yeah, and I have the corresponding TP of M.
Yeah.
Okay. And the point is you are trying to extend to you have another point Q, and then you have TQ of M, and the tangent bundle is the sum of all these things
but
together.
But the vector, so the tangent vector.
No, it's the vector of space. It's a piece of P. It's a piece
of P. So here I have V of P, here I have V of Q, and now if I let this run smoothly so that I am merging P and Q together, it will be something like, that is what is called V.
Okay, I think I just misunderstood.
So you may think about it also that I have a curve, so let's say I have a curve in my manifold, and I consider a tangent vector, so then the sum of all the tangent vectors at all the points will be a vector field. But of course, I have another one here, another one here. So for, if I cover the whole manifold with all these vectors, that's what a vector on the vector,
no,
what a vector field on the manifold is.
Yeah, I was just confused by the vertical line after V, because I thought that you were trying to say that P is in TP of M, but really it's V is in TP of M.
Yeah.
Some subscript.
Yeah. So okay. So let's call it this
it's
way.
V at P.
Let's call V at P. Oh, I don't know. V at P. Yeah. Yes?
You do need some smoothness condition of V with respect to P, right? Like basically some kind of a, if P and Q are closed, then V of P and V of Q are, have to be kind of
close. Yes. Yeah, they have to, yeah.
But like what exactly is that smoothness condition?
Well, you know that V, you have to act with this V on a function,
okay,
which is smooth. Okay, and then V of F, which is this thing here, defines a function on a manifold. Right? So then you know what a smoothness for a function on the manifold is. And this is, has to be true for any function f. Right? So, yeah. Does it answer your question?
Yeah, sure.
Any other question? Okay. So, I don't think I will cover everything I wanted, but maybe one more concept. So we now understand very well vectors. Okay, so now there is a dual concept to a vector, which is called a one-form or cotangent vector. So let me define this one here. Definition. A cotangent vector vector field, if you want, cotangent vector, or a one form. This will be obvious tomorrow why I call it a one form. Let's call it omega, again, at a point first, P and M, is again a map, is a map omega that goes from TP of M and gives me a real number. Okay, so it's an object that likes to eat vectors, and if it eats vector, it gives me a number. Okay, so now, well, that's a definition, but let me just continue to be a, like a theorem. So anyway, one forms form a vector space again, which is called cotangent vector space, cotangent vector space, so it looks like tangent, but to distinguish it from tangent, you put T star instead of T.
Do you want it to be a linear map?
Well, it is a linear map, yes. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Again, at P, N of my manifold M. So tangent vector spaces are T, cotangent vector spaces, or the dual spaces are T star of P. And then, again, because it's a vector space, you need a basis. So let's say I'll, again, use a coordinate basis is coordinate basis And to distinguish the basis d over dx mu from the basis of my different space, cotangent space, I put d of x mu. But it's, again, it's a vector, basis vector living in my cotangent vector space, which tells me what the basis is, dx mu. Okay. And so this one is defined through relation that dx mu acting on d over dx nu is delta mu nu. Okay, so everybody knows what delta is. It's a Kronecker delta, so it is equal to 1 if mu index is the same as nu index, so delta 1, 1 is 1, but if they are not equal, then it's 0, so delta 1, 2 is 0. Okay, so that's what on the right-hand side. So now this is the basis of my cotangent space, so it's a one form here, and this is my basis of my vector space, so it's a vector. So now one form eats a vector and produces a number. Okay, so this is how it is defined. So if I know what d over dx nu is, the basis, and we have already introduced that, then I just define the corresponding one form basis by this relation here. Okay, and then once you have this basis, then you write any omega, write omega as the components of omega, omega mu, and the basis. So again, these are the components. And this is my basis. Simple. Okay. So one forms like to eat vectors. Vectors like to eat functions. Functions like to eat points. Okay. So that's the hierarchy on the manifold, in some sense. Okay. So now again, this is an invariant object. So it doesn't matter what coordinates I'm using. So if I have omega written in one coordinate system as omega mu of x dx mu for coordinates x, then I use the fact how the differential transforms if I change the coordinates. So this is omega mu of x. And now I write dx mu as dx mu over dx prime nu, dx prime nu, right? Just using how the differential transforms. But this thing here, so this is my new basis, and this thing is my new component. So I get a transformation law that, so this must be omega nu prime at x prime. So I get a transformation law that omega nu prime at x prime is just omega mu at x, and that thing d dx mu over dx prime nu. So again, you may have seen this already. So the components of a one form or the components of a cotangent vector transform in this way. Again, there is this Einstein summation convention over mu. But the object itself remains invariant. Doesn't matter which coordinates I use. OK. Questions?
If I have a given manifold, would the tangent bundle be unique or not?
What do you mean unique?
Like,
so. Yeah, it is, if you want, it's a space, it's an additional U. Yeah. It's an additional structure to the manifold, and it lives in each point, so yeah, you can always define it, yeah. Well, maybe not always. Maybe there are some weird manifolds where you cannot do it. But usually you can. Yeah. So basically, you know, if I have the manifold, I just have to take these tangent spaces and I have to join all of them together And you know, unless there is some obstruction to do that, it is a unique thing. Okay, so now we have this a cotangent vector at a point. Of course, you can play the same game as this vector, so you can extend this to the whole manifold. Can say what a cotangent bundle T star of M, you know, unify everything over P, T star P of M, and the local coordinates on this thing again, I have to specify the point P, so it'll be x mu, and at the same time, I have to specify the components of my vector omega, so omega mu. So these are the local coordinates on the cotangent bundle. And so both bundles, the tangent bundle and the cotangent bundle, are just an example of something which is more general and it's called fiber bundles. So T star of M and T of M are examples of something which is called fiber bundles. Which I'm not going to discuss anymore, but yeah. So now you see that, you know, if I have tangent bundle of, or if I have cotangent bundle, I have like many coordinates. I have the coordinate x and I have the coordinate v here. And here I have the coordinate x and I have the coordinate omega. But sometimes it is useful to kill some of these things and make some projection. And so there is a, if you have tangent space, there's something which is called canonical projection. So you know that we let's say do it for the tangent bundle first. So V in T of M defines two things. Defines first the point P in M. And second, well, this is very schematically written, so and then V TP of M, so it defines both. It defines where I am and what is the corresponding vector in TP of M. Okay, and so you define the canonical projection pi, which goes from TM just to M, by basically forgetting what the vector part of this is. Okay, by pi of V equals to P, so that's the definition. So if you have these coordinates, pi, x1, x2, xn, v1, v2, and v of n, then what it gives you is that it just forgets the vector part and just gives you where the vector lives. So it just gives you the x1 to xn. Okay, so that's what a canonical projection pi is. And you can do the same thing for, so similarly, for T star of M. So again, if you have the cotangent bundle, you can forget these coordinates here, and you'll just get a point. So So it maps the whole tangent bundle. It always, for each point, it gives you that point. So you just forget this half of the coordinates. It's a very useful map. It's a very useful map. Huh, we are 5 minutes over time, but I cannot deny you what a tensor is. Okay, so let me just define a tensor, and let me finish here.
Does that thing has to be the collection of all C infinity functions, or it has to be just a collection of C infinity functions? What are you erasing?
Sorry, this thing?
Yeah.
F?
Yeah. Is
So basically what you are saying, well, it's a collection of functions.
All C infinity functions?
Yeah.
It could be a subset, because if you have a subset, then presumably you have more tangent, potentially you can have more tangent vectors, so you only have a subset.
I would say this is for all functions, but yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, you can play these games, of course, yeah. So if you say something is defined on, you know, a smaller group of of objects,
yeah,
then usually it's more general or whatever, yeah.
Yes.
You know, if it were true for only one function, you know,
yes,
then you may be lucky it's a very special function and the object is not really good object if you define it in that way. But if you require for all functions, then yeah, it's you know, the properties of the final definition is better. So a definition of a tensor which is schematically a product of vectors and forms, vectors and one forms, and has, you know, components, and components T alpha, beta, blah, blah, gamma, delta, blah, blah. Okay. So it has, you know, that many vector components and that many one-form components. So what it is, so this is very schematic, so definition. What it is, so a tensor of type K and L, okay, of rank k plus l is a multilinear map. So I have a tensor T and it maps objects which live in the tangent space and cotangent space. So TP star of m times TP star of M, and there is K of these, it's a product of these things, and then product is TP of M times TP of M, and there is L of those, and if it is at a point, then it gives you a real number. So a tensor likes to eat vectors, like to eat one forms, and gives you a number. And then from this definition, you can show that the components of the tensor, components transform, well, those indices which look like vector transform as a vector. Those indices which look like a one form transform as one form. Okay, so T prime, alpha, and so on, mu, and so on at x prime is dx prime alpha, dx delta, and so on, dx kappa, dx prime mu, and so on, T delta kappa of x. So basically each index transforms separately as if it were a vector or as if it were one form. So let me stop here. Are there any questions?
Okay. Yes. About the definition of the curve that you gave.
Okay.
If you only require the smoothness, it seems that the curve can intersect itself, right?
Is that true? Maybe it can. Yeah, because I require smoothness only differentially. That's probably true.
So
yeah.
You only require local smoothness.
Yeah.
So. According to your definition of manifolds, would be the case that some curves are not manifolds. Because if it intersects itself, then how can you map it to curve?
Is that true that it's not a it's a one-dimensional manifold. Question. I don't know. Let's think about it. Yeah, I don't know. Other questions? Okay, so see you tomorrow.